Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our guest is the awesome Sarah Duty, UX researcher, designer, and founder of Career Strategy Lab. And we're glad to have Sarah again today to talk about UX hiring. This show is brought to you by UserList, the best way for SaaS founders to send onboarding emails, segment your users based on events, and see where your customers get stuck in the product. Start your free trial today at userlist.com. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Jane. Good to be here again.
We are so glad to have you here today. It's been, 6 years that we've talked last time in 2016. We're going to link to that episode. It was actually hiring for UX positions. I'm looking at it right now. But you bet things have changed since then, right?
A lot has changed. That definitely feels like a lifetime ago, not just in terms of time, but you're right. Things have changed, especially with the pandemic and just evolution of our industry, to be honest.
You have been a prominent UX figure for many years. So you were, and you are even more prominent these days. You put out consistent newsletters about UX. You do content and training and whatever not. Tell us about yourself and what your current business baby is.
Good way to put it. So yeah, I am a user researcher and experience designer. And for the last, 10 years, I've been running my own consultancy where I work with companies, they hire me to do research, design, et cetera. But in the middle of that 9 or 10 year period of owning my own company, I started to get into the world of teaching user experience online. And I created some online classes about research and, frankly, somewhat accidentally fell into the world of UX career coaching. It started with helping people make portfolios because really I was kind of solving my own problem selfishly because I was tired of people asking me how to do this. So I thought, I'll just make a little course. And then when people ask me, I'll just tell them to go do that so I don't have to repeat myself. But then to my surprise, people started to get hired. And that was kind of the real genesis of what I'm doing now, which is Career Strategy Lab, a 6-month UX career accelerator that is not a boot camp. So we will not teach you UX 101, et cetera. We teach you how to go through your entire job search, or if your goal isn't to get hired right now, it's really to be in a place where should opportunities come your way, you are ready to go and don't need to rush and have this stressful weekend of putting all your materials together.
There are so many misconceptions and the giant misunderstanding between the hiring party and the party that is being hired. So today's episode, maybe we can touch upon both sides, but mostly talk about the companies who are looking for UX specialists and the problems they deal with so that those UX specialists who are listening to us today can get that insight that will help them adjust their message. So what is happening on the UX side in the companies? It feels like companies are short of talent.
I would anecdotally agree. I don't have hard data on that. But yeah, I think that companies are really struggling to hire talent fast enough. There's many variables involved with that. And I think the first variable maybe we could talk about is trying to find those more senior candidates. So maybe people who've been working in UX for, let's say, 5 or more years, because it seems like a lot of them, they kind of have a lot of opportunities right now. They could be consulting on their own. They could pick and choose which companies they go to based on compensation and opportunity to work remotely and things like that. So those mid and senior candidates, I think, have a lot of opportunity to kind of be very picky, if that makes sense. And one thing I found, so for context, a lot of what I'm going to say and draw from is really rooted in a bunch of research I did in the fall of 2021, where I hosted a virtual conference. And as a part of that, I interviewed hiring managers from Facebook, IBM, Shopify, Gusto, and a person that specialized in UX recruiting and has their own recruiting firm. And one of the things they said was, in order to kind of attract and be more appealing to candidates, they're really doing a lot to showcase their design cultures, opportunity to grow, etc. So it's almost like they're trying to sell candidates, you know?
It does feel like companies are more in the submissive positions, sort of display. Yeah, that makes sense.
They're spending a lot of money on marketing. You know, you've maybe seen advertisements, companies showcasing their culture. I know for a while, Shopify was doing a lot of content promotion. And this is why you see a lot of the companies having their own, you know, podcasts. Shopify has their own podcast about like working at Shopify and their culture. Some of these companies also, you'll notice, have Medium publications or are really putting themselves out there to make candidates realize, hey, maybe you've never heard about us before, but we're a great place to work. And I think Gusto is a great example of that, because a lot of people may not have heard of Gusto. And for context, Gusto is a, I'm not sure the exact definition, but I would say like a people management platform for companies. So you can run payroll through there. Your employees can do time tracking, et cetera. I personally am a customer of Gusto because I have employees and we have payroll. But I think one interesting variable in hiring right now is candidates often have, I guess you could say, a narrow vision of where they want to work. And it's this, I think, kind of unhealthy obsession with working at FANG companies or others that fall into that category. And they're missing out on opportunities to work at other awesome companies where it might be a little bit more of a better culture fit or opportunity to grow, because it's a, you know, maybe smaller company that can move a little faster, or might have, the managers might have more time to actually mentor rather than just manage and go to meetings at a larger company.
I'd like to mention that there is also another side of the game, and these are freelancers from other countries, like myself coming from Russia. Maybe 10 years ago when I was starting, I couldn't think that I could be of use as a hired person. So I was looking for freelance gigs, and finding freelance gigs for a designer, it's pretty hard compared as for a developer, for example. Developer could work on one or two projects a year. Designer's projects last like a few weeks and you're done. So it's a completely different pipeline. So there are people out there not even realizing they might be better off full-time or part-time versus freelance, right?
Definitely. And I think there's kind of an allure of doing freelance right now, especially I would wager that the pandemic has kind of ignited this desire to be freelance and nomadic and all this, you know, so that when you can travel more freely, you can do that. But a lot of people don't think of the business side of running a freelance, you know, business, which I'm sure maybe you have a podcast episode on, but, you know, there's a lot that goes into thinking about, depending on where you live, taxes and other expenses that come up as a freelancer. So yeah, you might want to do that. But I think with the way work has changed because of the pandemic, the ability to often work remotely and things like that, it's kind of, I think, the best of both worlds, because you can have the guarantee of a salary, but be able to have some of those perks that you probably wanted as a freelancer, like flexibility of location, hours, etc.
Let's talk about job role titles. And has the industry finally come to peace, you know, and convention when it comes to what people do in UX positions, or is there still misunderstandings there?
I think there are still misunderstandings and lack of standardization. And I'm not really sure we will ever get to a place where product designer means the same thing at all companies. And in the career strategy lab where I work with UX people to help them get hired, the thing I tell them over and over is don't obsess about job titles. I remember, you know, years ago, gosh, 15, maybe even 20 years ago now, I remember kind of strategizing with a friend early in my career, and we were kind of graphic designers, web designers at the time. And there was kind of this natural progression of like designer to senior designer to art director to creative director. And you kind of knew what that meant. But today, I think our job titles are all over the place. And that's why I tell the candidates, almost ignore the job title and really comb through that job description. And I think on the company side of things, one thing that they could do is, you know, when you see a job title on LinkedIn Jobs or something and it says UX researcher one, or, you know, staff product designer, like that's meaningless. That's just a word, a phrase in a database related to their HR department so that they can determine, you know, probably salaries and things like that, I imagine. So I say, put less thought and stress around job titles and really hone in on those job descriptions. Cause it's like the tip of the iceberg, right? The job title is just a tiny, tiny sliver of what you're actually going to do. You can't base the job off the title for sure.
But the range of things a UX person can do is so, like, the spectrum is so wide, from research to wireframing to some, you know, mid-fidelity mockups to high-fidelity mockups to branding to implementation of the front-end coding, and then to motion animation, anything virtually. What can a person realistically do? Do they have to be aiming at the whole spectrum? How do they pick what they're best at?
Yeah, this is a question that I'm asked so often, especially with people who are coming into UX, whether it's their first job ever or they're switching from another field. I think some people may have an idea of where they want to specialize. So for example, in my career coaching program, I had someone who was, I believe they were some type of investigative journalist, and someone else was a psychologist, and they were both switching into user experience and knew that they wanted to kind of focus on research. So for those people that may not have some inkling or previous experience that kind of nudges them towards a specific part of UX, I think that the best thing they can do is spend, you know, 1, 2, 3 years kind of experimenting with your own career and figure out, do you like doing research? Do you gravitate towards interface design versus visual design? Do you suddenly realize you love UX writing, you know? But you'll never know that unless you participate in that and see where your strengths and interests kind of align, you know? And I think there's that whole concept of the T-shaped designer. I think Jared Spool has a couple of great articles on that. But, you know, I think regardless of what you do, whether you stay kind of more generalist or go down a more specialized path, I think that when it comes to getting hired as a candidate and then what companies look for, you will always stand out, or increase your chances of standing out, I should say, if you have some knowledge in those other things. So if you are a interface designer, you know, you make pixel perfect designs, et cetera, and you also have a little bit of experience with research or would be comfortable doing usability tests on your own designs, that's going to help you stand out, right? Or if you are an interface designer and you have just basic knowledge of front-end development, HTML, CSS, et cetera, that's again going to be very valuable, because UX doesn't happen in a silo, right? You are going to have to collaborate with the developers or the researchers or the marketing team or the sales team or customer service. So any experience you have in other areas will definitely help you stand out. And that's really important as a candidate to kind of shine a spotlight on those things, because imagine you're a hiring manager going through 50 resumes or applications in a day. You know, you don't want to make them kind of go on an expedition or mining your resume and your portfolio to try and find these key details that, oh, you were a psychologist before you got into UX. Like, that's probably going to be valuable from a research perspective. So one of the things that hiring managers said, and this is kind of a phrase we often use in UX, but don't make me think, right? It's that Steve Krug book. It applies to when you are doing your job as a UX person, but it also applies to the experience of you getting hired. Don't make the hiring managers think. For example, if you have 5 years of experience, in the cover letter you send or at the top of your resume, don't just put Sarah Duty, user researcher and experience designer, put Sarah Duty, 5 years experience or mid-level or senior user experience designer. That's an example of little things you can do to not make them think. This came up over and over in discussions with the hiring managers.
By the way, are the hiring managers typically not design versed, or would that be a product lead? Like, is a designer hiring out the designers, or is it HR department filtering those first and then you might have an interview with somebody in the department?
That's a great question. And it seems like it depends on the size of the company, right? Because a large company like Facebook or Shopify, they have, you know, significant HR departments. And so you have to understand the users in the situation of you getting hired. And there might be someone in the HR department that has never worked in user experience, but has a working knowledge of user experience. You know, if you're applying to a small UX agency where there is no HR department, the first person looking at your resume or your LinkedIn might actually be your potential future boss. So that's why it's really important to be very strategic with what I refer to as your career materials. So resume, portfolio, LinkedIn, cover letters, etc. Because two reasons, actually. Number one, you don't know which of those things people will look at first. Do they look at your resume first, your LinkedIn first, your portfolio first? It varies, you know? And you don't know, is that HR person going to look at it first? Might it go to the, you know, head of the department that you're going to work in? So a lot of people just kind of put a lot of weight on one of those things. And I think that's why a lot of people apply to roles and don't hear back, because they might have a strong resume or a strong portfolio, but if there's a weak link in all that, it's putting that first impression at risk.
I'm surprised, as having been in a hiring manager myself, not for designers, but for other roles, I'm surprised by a number of candidates that are strong, but have zero online presence. Neither personal nor professional. I understand why they might not be, you know, willing to put up their puppies online, but if you are a professional with a 5 years experience, why don't you, you know, put up a website or at least a strong LinkedIn page?
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I think it's probably a 50-50 toss-up that if you're being considered for a role, people will Google you, and there is zero excuse, in my opinion, for not having a LinkedIn profile, you know, that is flushed out with relevant content and not just, you know, an item in your job history that has no bullet points or text below it, you know. And there's a lot of things you can do on your LinkedIn profile that people aren't aware of. You can attach PDFs or links to items in your job history. You can have a little featured section where you can order the things. So a LinkedIn, a really well done LinkedIn profile can be almost, you know, a surrogate for having a website if you don't have the time to do that. But one, I love that you brought up websites because I think UX people think, oh, I need to have some personal presence online. I need to make a website. And then that becomes this bloated project that stresses them out and they never finish it or they rush it and it's not very good. And so I think it's the irony of not treating that like a normal project, right? And maybe the MVP version of that is a one-page website that just has kind of an about me statement and I don't know what you're looking for. So we need to make sure we don't fall into the trap of, you know, letting our personal presence become this bloated product that doesn't make sense.
A one-pager website can really tell a lot about your UX, your design aesthetics, your understanding of communication, so much, even if on a one-pager, like business card-like website.
Yes. No, I think it's an excellent constraint, kind of challenge to give yourself. Maybe that's like a little design sprint people can do. Like, what is the one-page version of your website, you know? And I think for people just starting out, let's say you just graduated from a boot camp or something like that, I think there is this trend, let's say, but also I know for a fact some boot camps require the portfolio to be a website, which I wholeheartedly disagree with. Because if you're just starting out in your career, like not every single person who works in UX needs to know how to make a multi-page website and do beautiful layouts and everything, right? Like a UX writer doesn't need to know how to make a pixel perfect, beautiful website. But I don't want to derail us. If you're just starting out, I think put the focus on your portfolio presentation and later on make that website or just make a one-page website. Because if you're just starting out, the goal is to get hired. And if you make a website, that could likely take many months. And I know this because many people who've worked with me have said that to me. So make that presentation first, and then you will have the content needed for that website when you have time to make that.
I can see there is business to be made approaching designers without websites and making one pagers for them. No, just kidding. Let's imagine there's a layer of our listeners who are startups, medium size, mature enough to have some design in-house finally, but there is nobody on the design team. There is, let's imagine, a CEO, developer, a customer success person, nobody who can do design. Who will be that ideal first design hire for them? And how do they go about finding one?
This is such a great question. I think that they probably want to be looking for that more generalist, for lack of a better word, designer, because they will need someone who can kind of take a project feature idea from start to finish, right? And knowing that, you also need to make sure that this person has skills that extend beyond just they can do research, they can make wireframes, they can make, you know, semi-polished designs, etc. But in such a small team, you also want to make sure that that person has, you know, working business knowledge or industry knowledge of that industry. Or if they don't, their previous experience shows you they can quickly ramp up on different projects, you know? So, for example, I worked for years as a contractor with a UX agency in New York City. And one of the things I loved the most was I was always getting to learn about a new industry. So 1 month it would be about finance, and then we were onto healthcare. And so that might be a quality to look for in someone you're hiring. And I think their resume and LinkedIn are a great place to kind of look and see if they have that experience. So trying to find this person, you know, I think word of mouth is always, in my opinion, the best, because that helps kind of pre-vet those candidates. So if you're an early-ish stage startup, you know, maybe you've been a part of different startup programs, incubators, et cetera. I would start there. You know, people are going to give you very honest feedback of the people they've worked with. And then I would kind of branch out, maybe go on LinkedIn, do some Google searches. I think phrases like UX designer or product designer, early stage startup, startup projects, you know, you'll start to quickly find people that match that description. But word of mouth is great. That's where I would start.
How would one get an idea of what's appropriate compensation? I'm not asking for specific numbers here, but how can you even think about it?
So this question has so many variables involved with it. And I think that you need to not focus on the literal, you know, amount. So I'm speaking from the side of you're the company hiring the people, especially if you're a startup, because I know after working with a lot of startups, they love it when the amount is low, right? They're always trying to save money, et cetera. And I've worked with a lot of startups that went that route and hired someone for a very low fee. And maybe there was a high volume of wireframes produced, but it kind of wasn't functional, you know? And so I think that it should go without saying, but I think we do need to say it. You can't, you know, focus on dollar amount or whatever currency you're in. So I think that as a company, you need to think about what is the value that I'm going to get out of this. So for example, if you are hiring someone to help you with your onboarding experience of your product, because maybe people are coming to your homepage and not signing up for the free trial, or maybe they're signing up for the free trial, but they're not turning into a paying customer. So if you could solve those problems, that's going to result in a lot of revenue for your company, probably, right? Because you're going to get paying customers, you know? And so to me, that's an example of what I would refer to as kind of value-based pricing. Like, how valuable is solving this problem? So that's one way to think about it. I think there's another conversation around, do you think about projects on an hourly basis or kind of a project basis? And I think it's really valuable to think about individual projects, because from my experience and talking with so many other people, hourly just kind of sets everyone up to be let down, you know, like hourly can result in the company getting a really big bill and being shocked. And it can also result in the actual consultant, freelancer, et cetera, you know, not being able to prioritize other projects, having something that they thought may take 20 hours drag on for 60 hours. So I think if you can price things from a project perspective, it helps eliminate a lot of uncertainty for everyone's part.
In my old consulting days, one of the most effective formats was to get together either on per project basis, and I used to bill weekly, because it's still hard to escape from the time entirely, but at least weekly can change it from hourly to project scope. So a startup would, for example, aggregate their needs and then get in touch with me when they have enough needs to cover 1 week, and then we would do it together. Another format was, in the very early days, we would get together for 2 or 3 days every month on a repeatable basis. That was a retainer. In a similar fashion, I would do things that they need. And trust me, 3 days from a good designer is much better than 2 weeks from a mediocre designer. Like, seriously.
Yeah. And the other thing that you mentioned that kind of reminded me of something is, if you are, and this applies to whether you're hiring or you're trying to get hired as a freelancer, if you're feeling like there is a lack of clarity around what is going to be done, one of the things I used to do is kind of have companies pay me for an initial, for lack of better word, like discovery or scope project, where maybe it's a day, maybe it's 2 days, maybe it's a week. But at the end of that, the goal is to have kind of a product roadmap, let's say, like a miniature product roadmap, so that even if the company didn't hire me, they would have a lot more clarity on what they were doing, the order in which they were doing things, et cetera. So it was kind of, it was solving a problem on my part where I didn't want to spend, you know, 2 weeks going back and forth with the company scoping this project. I'd rather just do a half day workshop with them and charge them for that. And then I know what we're making. And even if they don't hire me, they got a lot of value of what they're making.
That applies to any industry. For example, yeah. Our SEO consultant, we first had him to build a content roadmap for us. And I've never seen such a detailed roadmap before. So we were astounded and thrilled to hire them for further work. And in my old days, also the UI audits were popular offering when we were doing something like that. And that could or could not include manual work depending on the package and depending on the budget. So there's so many ways to work together if you are creative with it.
Yeah. No, those audits are such a great example because, you know, even if someone didn't hire me to fix what I found in an audit, they would at least be able to go hire someone else with a lot more clarity or hand off to their internal team, like the very obvious things that needed changing.
As we're wrapping up today's episode, what would be one ultimate piece of advice for UX designers listening to us? How can they improve their chances of being hired? What should they do better?
I think that one trend I see, and it's kind of ironic, is that UX people often don't treat their career and the process of getting hired like an actual UX project or, you know, themselves like a product. You know, your resume is a product, your LinkedIn profile is a product, your portfolio is a product, right? And so when you don't treat all of that like a product or like a UX project, you end up, you know, not meeting the needs of your users, or you skip over focusing on content and strategy and you jump right to design. And you might have a resume that looks nice, but it might be overly designed and it has very, you know, vague and surface level bullet points. And so I think that if everyone could do that, it would help solve a lot of problems and it would drastically reduce the amount of time that UX people take to get everything kind of in tip-top shape, ready to press that apply button.
That's great advice. Thanks so much for sharing your advice today with us, Sarah. Where can people learn more and hear more of what you write and your bootcamp program?
Yes. So Career Strategy Lab is just careerstrategylab.com. That will take you to the website where you can apply. We make you fill out an application, or we have lots of articles and videos on that website. And then on social media, on Twitter and YouTube, I am just Sarah Duty, first name, last name. And on Instagram, I am Sarah Duty UX at the end.
Amazing. Thanks so much once again, and have a wonderful 2022.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Jane.